in our country, they've had contests where the first prize is a week in Philadelphia. Second prize is 2 weeks in Philadelphia. What I'd like to do in the sessions today and tomorrow is to take a lot of the pieces that we have been working with and try to put them together. In a way, I have been working somewhat inductively, but perhaps if I can put the process together, it will be of some help in seeing how the pieces fit into the whole. I think one of the things that would be helpful as we begin is to ask, in terms of homiletics, what we are attempting to accomplish in terms of the form of the sermon. That is, if a sermon is well prepared, then what is the underlying form? Gotta be a parable there someplace. What is the underlying form that we are trying to get at? So if you think of all of the rules of homiletics, and we have a lot of rules, those rules can be broken. What you are trying to do in the teaching of rules is to get it formed. Very difficult to get to the form directly. So a lot of the rules, we say, what you have to have in an introduction and transitions and so forth, is really a way of coming down to the substrata. So we're asking, what is the form of a good sermon? One thing that characterizes a well-prepared sermon is that it has a sense of unity. We talk about unity. We are talking about many things that would ordinarily be separated coming together into a singleness that either was not recognized before or did not exist before. You talk about unity, we are talking about the several things that ordinarily may not be put together, coming together into this singleness, into this oneness that either was not recognized before or did not exist before. You talk about unity, a finger is a singularity. When you put it together with three other fingers and a thumb and a palm, it becomes part of the unity that we call the hand. There's also a way, I suppose, in which a finger is a unity if you break it up into nails, skin, knuckles, so forth. Those are separate parts that come together into a oneness. But unity is several things that are ordinarily separated, coming together into a oneness that either did not exist before, that is, you are making that, or was not recognized before. Now, when we say that a good sermon has a sense of unity, we're really talking about a law of the listener's mind. That is, there is no biblical mandate that there be unity in a sermon, except that there is unity in the way God has created things. In ecology, we are discovering that things that we thought were all very separate from one another actually form a oneness, which when you break the oneness can almost destroy the planet. But basically, unity is a law of the listener's mind. That is, we cannot look at things that are separated and keep them separated. We will try to put them together. We will force upon them some kind of unity. For example, you go out into the night and gaze up into the sky. And there are billions and billions of stars
in outer space. You look up and you say, there's the Big Dipper or the Little Dipper. You get that in this part of the world? You guys not only change the seasons, you change the stars. But you get the, you say, there's the Hunter. Or we say, there's the Milky Way. As though it was just sort of one big sweep of white. Now, there really isn't a Big Dipper, a Little Dipper up there, or a Hunter, or the Bear, or even a Milky Way. But you've got billions of stars, light years apart. But when we look up at them, we impose upon them a unity. So we see things in the stars that are really random, but we impose upon them a picture. It's a law of the listener's mind. Or if you stand outside and look at the pavement, you discover that the pavement is cracked. The water has done its work. And then as you look at it for a while, it seems to form a design. Well, this crack doesn't fit, but this forms a design over here. And it looks like a state. Looks like a country. You can't look at it for very long without seeing some kind of pattern. The pattern isn't there, the pattern's here. In psychology, the psychologist uses the Rorschach test. Rorschach test simply takes ink, puts it on paper, folds the paper over, and then there is a design. It is a random design. But then you show it to people. Say, what do you see here? I say, I see a knife. I see a leaf. I see a spaceship. If you ask enough people about those ink blots, you begin to learn what's inside of people's heads. A man who goes to the psychologist looks at those ink blots and says, what do you see there? The guy says, oh man, that reminds me of sex. So he shows him another one. What is it? What are those? Boy, that reminds me of sex. Takes a third one, shows him the blot. Whew, man, hey, that's sex. The psychologist says, your problem is you're obsessed with sex. Guy says, me? Who's been showing me the dirty pictures all morning? Well, what you're dealing with is obviously something inside of people's heads. It's a unity. It's a law of the listener's mind. It means, of course, if you present a sermon and don't pull it together, the congregation, people in the congregation, if they're listening, will impose a unity. You may discover, to your amazement, it is very different than what you intended. Now, in a sermon, the unity is of a particular kind. There's all kinds of ways of communicating ideas. One way of doing it would be to look at a picture. A picture is a unity. When you look at the picture, there it is, full and complete. And what hits you when you look at a picture is the unity. You see the whole thing. Now, if you're an art critic, you will take a little piece of cardboard and you may look at each particular part to see how the artist has put the picture together. But before you ever look at the particulars in a picture, you see the whole. A sermon isn't that way. A sermon is a unity transmitted in time. It starts at 11:05 and stops at 20 minutes to 12. In that sense, a sermon is like a symphony. One note has to be played before the next one. It's like a play. You have one scene before you can have the next scene, and one act before you can have the next act. It's a unity that is transmitted in time. It is less like a book. A book is a unity transmitted in time, that you have to read this page before you get to the next page. But unlike a book, the unity transmitted in time keeps on going. If you read a book, you look at the middle of a chapter and you think, oh man, I'm not sure I follow this. Then you go back and read the chapter over again. Take it at your own pace. Can't do that with a sermon. You're sitting there listening to a sermon. When you don't follow what the preacher is saying, you cannot lean over to your wife and say, I don't follow. I mean, she may stop and say, well, you know, let me explain what he's talking about. But if she does that, the preacher keeps on going. By the time they look up from their conversation, they have lost them, or he has lost them. A book? Man, you can control the book. You can't control the preacher. So it is a unity transmitted in time. As obvious as that sounds, it governs a lot of things that you do in preaching. Growing out of the fact that the sermon is a unity, a oneness that brings many things together that either wasn't recognized before or didn't exist before, it's a unity transmitted in time. Then growing out of that is that in preaching, a second thing we have besides unity is order. If I have prepared a sermon well, it may sit before me as an outline and as a unity, almost like a picture. That is, I can see on the page the introduction, the major movements of the sermon, the conclusion. It's like a picture. The whole thing's very clear to me. Hopefully, when you get up, you know where you're going to go. You know where you're going to end. So you see it whole, complete. Difficulty is that I cannot transmit it that way. If I simply hand out the outlines, that's not the sermon. So what I have to do is to transmit this to the congregation, this unity in time, one piece at a time. So I start at the beginning, which is, according to Julie Andrews, a very good place to begin. And then I come to a transition. That has to fit. I move to a first point. That's got to fit. And then I am going to develop that point. And what I develop has to fit the movement I'm developing. Then the next point has to be given. I have to give to the congregation each bit of material at the time they need it. I have to, because it's in order, relate it to what I have given them before. Have to relate it to what is following. If I simply just throw it all out with no sense of order, then it's like giving children a group of building blocks. And the house they construct may be very different than the airplane I thought I was getting them to build. They will put it, if they're listening at all, they'll put it together, but it'll have very different shapes. So I've got to give it to you one piece at a time, exactly when you need it. It has to fit. You have to know that what I'm talking about now is really a sub-development of a major movement. If you don't know that, if I don't tell you that, if I don't show you that, you may decide that this sub-point, if we can talk about outlines, is really a main point. And if you decide that's really a main point, and it's really, you know, in terms of an outline, a little A under a Arabic number, under, you know, another A under a Roman numeral, if it's down here, and I have not made it clear that it is really a supporting point, then you'll move it over as a major assertion of the sermon. And often that's what occurs. You've all had that experience of people picking up a sub-point that was really related to something else, but the person thought it was a major thing you were saying. And you say, oh, no, I wasn't saying that at all. But if it's a unity transmitted in time, then in the sense of order, I have got to give it to you a bit at a time. I've got to show you where that bit fits. That means that if I am working well, I am very concerned about the connections in the sermon. I can't take them for granted. I can't decide. You will know exactly where this ought to fit. A writer, a good writer, will tend to say something once. He will try to fashion that sentence so he says it well. If you've done writing, you know that redundancy, saying things over and over again, doesn't work with readers. It tends to be heavy. So you try to craft the sentences so that you hit it the first time and it is said and it's done well. You can't do that when you're speaking. In speaking, you know that there has to be repetition. The ear is not nearly as dependable as the eye. Yesterday, as we were watching Hybels, and he was saying, you know, people matter to God, I lost count. But he said that at least 25 times. I was sitting here, just, you know, in and out, you know, until you decided it must have been saying that people matter to God. If you did that in writing, you'd get tired of it. But what he wanted to do is, he was dealing with sub-material over here, but he wanted you to remember that this is what the point he was making. Okay. So the ear is not as dependable as the eye, so I have to learn to restate things. Repeat them, restate them, because I know one shot won't do it. But that's how the order is. I have to be sure that what I'm giving it is orderly. But because it's transmitted in time, I've got to show you where each thing fits. Okay, that's the second thing. There's a third characteristic of a well-designed message. Unity and order. But the third is a sense of progress. These two are not three separate entities. They are part of the same dynamic. But it is conceivable that you could have a unity that wasn't going anywhere. That is, I could give you this point and then relate it to the next point and then relate it to the next point and then say, oh, well, it's 12 o'clock, let's quit, we'll pick it up next week, you know, that kind of thing. But if it is really a unity transmitted in time and there is a sense of order, then out of that there comes a sense of progress, a sense of movement. Good sermons have that sense that this preacher knows where he's going and he's going to get there. And he's going to get there with the greatest economy of means possible. He knows that if he's out chasing lions, he'd better not start chasing rabbits or he'll lose the lion. So you have that awareness in a good sermon, that it's got progress, it's got movement. It grows out of order. It is heightened by transitions.
that is coming out of the introduction. I go to the first major movement of the sermon, and I use the word movement deliberately. It is a movement, like a conversation. It's going someplace. From the first to the second, the third, wherever it is. But you're aware that there's a destination in mind and the person is getting there. I am persuaded that it's an overstatement, but very few long sermons. Often what hits us as being long is a sermon that has stopped moving. I think I mentioned to you the other day that you get to where you're going at 10 minutes to 12 and the service closes at 12, best thing in the world you can do is stop. Other Sundays, you got to go to 5 after 12, 10 after 12 in order to make it go, because that's the only way you can get to that destination. Okay. Congregation knows that you'll quit when you're finished. Be patient with it. But we have all listened to people who were finished 15, 20, 25 minutes into the sermon, but they didn't quit. I have, from time to time in the United States, preached on television, morning worship service. I hate it. The kind of thing you get when you get up is... 5 minutes to go, there'll be a little red light. 3 minutes to go, there'll be a blue light. 1 minute to go, all three lights up there start blinking. That means, you know, you better get it off. I can almost tell you when I get up to preach, within 5 minutes, how long I'll be. But there's something about those lousy lights. They start blinking at you, you know? And if they said you'll have 32 minutes, you know, that's okay. I can work with that. But the song leader decides he wants to sing an extra verse. Well, the announcements go longer. So you can have any place, they'll tell you, any place between... 25 minutes, and maybe, you know, sometimes it'll go, you know, you may even have 35 minutes. You think about that. They give me a 10 minutes leyway. So one question I have is, suppose I quit early. Well, sometimes I say, well, we can have a hymn. Other times, you know, you can't do that because we like to come right off at the end. Well, I have had the awful experience of having to preach longer when I was finished. I mean, I had, you know, turned the corner, I was into my conclusion, and the lights hadn't come on yet. Well, that's what that does, is it destroys your sense of progress. Because you start just sort of expanding, you're just talking, you're putting more sentences. Good communication has a strong sense of progress. Good drama has a sense of going someplace. You watch a good television program, a mystery, and it moves. You don't want to miss any of it because it's going someplace. So it's unity and order and a sense of progress. The progress is heightened by the wise use of transitions. It is heightened by having the material at the end of your sermon that has the greatest strength. The greatest strength is in the middle of your sermon. Then after that, everything kind of, we say it's an anti-climax. That is, you got to your destination, but somehow you decide you had to keep on going. But unity and order and progress, that's what we're aiming for. And it grows out of the fact that unity is a law of a listener's mind. And that this unity is transmitted in time. There are things you do in preaching that you don't do in other communication, or in public speaking, that you don't do in other communication. Because
what can be assumed in other communication, that is, you'll get the connection, cannot be assumed when you're preaching. All right, any questions about that? That's what we were trying, that's what, ultimately, we put it together, that's what we're trying to do. Peter?
What happens if your middle point really is your best point, the strongest point in your
Sometimes you can rearrange your points. Sometimes you discover that what you have is your third point can work as your second point. If you said, no, what I really wanted to get across to the congregation was my third point, I mean, that's what I think is the most important point, then what you mean is that I've got, you know, striking material in my second point. I don't have quite the striking material in my third point. But if you're saying that, then you cannot go with the material in your second point that you wanted to go with without doing damage to your third point. That is, you have to, often what you will get will be a strong illustration. Touches people intellectually, emotionally, you know. What you have to do is to lessen that. You just, and everything about you as a preacher, man, I mean, you go with this. You know, I was at the convention and I heard it, and man, well, woo! But you can't. As a communicator, you know what that will do. It will diminish what you're really trying to accomplish. And ultimately, you're not a storyteller. Ultimately, you're trying to communicate in a way that will get across God's truth in an effective fashion. So you have to offer. And it's awfully difficult to do. You refashion the point so it does not have that kind of emotional weight. Yes? Yeah. Good. That would be, we're chatting about this coming over. I thought what was his third point, that God cares about people, and he had the last one about he had the double R's, I can't even remember it. His sermon really came to a climax before his last point. In fact, he signaled a lot of things. Remember, he said we have one more point, something about the interests of staying within the time constraints. Remember that? All of that was a way of saying the progress is stopping. I mean, if he was going to do it, it didn't do any good to tell me about the time. The sermon came to its height after the third point. I'm kind of a professional listener, but I remember the last point had two R's to it. What is it? Yeah, okay. That's hard to remember. Because all of his emotional, and I mean emotional in the good sense, it came to bear at the end of that third point. The last point he put in, it was a valid point, and I thought he picked it up, and it helped. I mean, I didn't sit there just wanting to bail out. But in terms of what we're talking about, homiletic, I don't sue as a critic. That last point, if it was an important point, didn't get the service it deserved. What? Yeah, yeah. He because those points, you know, would have worked. They were not sequential. But I thought the way he had it arranged when he got to the end of his third point, I thought, you know, I felt it. I was moved by it. And I moved again, having heard it once before. But that last point, the progress stopped, that's all. And you've sensed that. Sure, we all do that, don't we? A lot of people, instead of having a good conclusion, conclude in their prayer. They tell God what they were intending to say. I mean, we all have done that. And having, I mean, I thought I thought it was a, you know, an excellent sermon, and it spoke to me. But and so we're not talking about the sermon or Bill Hybels. We are talking about unity, order, and progress. And
Second Thessalonians. And as I come to the end of 2 Thessalonians, how do I deal with the benediction conclusion? Because it seems to be a bit of a leftover. Do you leave that alone when you're doing an exposition?
Yeah, well, you have various, it seems like a series of comments or exhortations. Sometimes I look at those and ask, you know, is there a way in which, is it just a random series of comments? That's the first thing. Very seldom do you, as a person, write a series of comments without some kind of unity to them. The unity may not be the tight unity of a great idea, but it's almost impossible if you're writing a letter to just jot down a series of comments without any kind of order, just, you know, buckshot. So sometimes as I look at those, I look at that. Sometimes you will find you come to that and you impose an order on it. That is, and that may even mean that you rearrange it, that he's got, you know, two things to say to the family, two things to say about people on the outside, even though they may not fall in order. You impose some order on it, because you find, in terms of homiletics, the toughest thing in the world to preach is lists. You know, you have to warn students, stay away from lists. Get the fruit of the Spirit. You know, it's a great list. Tough preaching. What you almost always will do is divide that into three groups of three. Somehow, we know that people can handle a group of five. Give people a group of six, almost always they'll divide it into two groups. Give a group of nine things, and they'll divide it up. And the mind does that. So you got this list. You try to memorize it. You'll divide it up. Lists are difficult. Sometimes, as our students are preaching in chapel, when the faculty evaluates the student sermons, and sometimes in terms of homiletics, I think we ought to have sort of an Olympic scoring session. You know, to say there are passages of the Bible, you know, that are a five. As a, you know, some dives are a five, some are four, some are three in the Olympics. You know, I mean, there are some passages that are tough passages. And a student handling a tough passage, well, ought to get, you know, some mark better than the fellow that takes a very simple passage. And lists are that way. So you're really asking about the difficulty of communicating them without going off in a whole bunch of different directions. So almost always you will impose on that list some kind of order. Now, it may not be Paul, you'd have to say, well, Paul didn't have an order, he just had a list. But that's what occurs.
You put peace, I'm writing this with my own hand and grace, in some kind of unity.
Well, I'm just talking off the top of my head. The peace and grace look like they'll fit. You got him in the, you know, he's right. But you might ask yourself, why is it that he makes the point that he's writing it with his own hand? We know that Paul doesn't do this very often. We know that when he wrote to the Galatians, he said essentially the same thing, but he said, you can see with what large letters I have written. But evidently he is a man who is, you know, afflicted with, we know he was afflicted with some kind of thorn in the skin, but so you might say the man who is writing about God's peace and God's grace is a man who, as far as we know, was in difficult situations, physically, personally, traveling. So this isn't somebody sitting up in an ivory tower talking about peace. He's a man who testifies that all hell broke loose wherever he went. And when he went to the Thessalonians, he found difficulties. And he might do that. whether or not Paul was trying to put that over, but you're just trying, I mean, you could cover the material, but again, you try to give it a sense of unity.
Have you ever seen Dr. Fred Price preaching
at all? No, I have not.
To me, in some cases, if he seems to hit a flat spot, he seems to over-exaggerate his movements or his voice or whatever. Does that happen often, or can it do a lot of damage?
Well, we all know the truth. There's one of the old manuscripts, French manuscripts, that have come down to us, the sermons of Fenelon, has in the margin something about pound here. He may, simply because of the school of thought he came out of, may have really been talking about gestures, but I think there are many times we sense that we're talking louder or pounding harder because the sermon isn't going very well. You will seldom overcome a lack of unity by an increase in volume. But I don't know what you do. Yeah.
Sir, the order is concerned. Can we mess with the order, the chronological order in the text?
So yes, we get I think you can. Mm-hmm. I think if you have a psychological order, for example, of cause to effect, and you handle it with effect back to cause, you start with the effect and ask, how did this come about? You're still true to the form of the text. Every time you preach, there's a sense in which you are taking a passage out of its broader context. That is, when Paul is writing Romans, he is writing what I think is a theological treatise. I think he is not writing a standard letter. I think he once wanted to set down the faith. But as you know, he starts by the need and then talks about how Jesus can meet the need and then deals with the problem of how declared righteousness becomes actual righteousness and then applies it at the end. So he has a sense of order and progress in the epistle. But you're dipping in to chapter 5. You have a sermon that starts someplace and ends someplace. And your order cannot always be his order, because his order is the entire book. So my question is, as I work with this, is how can I communicate this truth the way Paul develops it? But how can I commit this so that when I'm through, people will know where I got it from? It will really expound this and touch people's lives. Now, whatever it takes in rearranging that, as far as I can see, that's fine. If in my rearranging it, I destroy Paul's argument, I'm saying something Paul isn't saying, then, of course, that's not exposition. But the order of the text is often much wider. For example, you have in the epistles the standard arrangement that the first part of the book deals with doctrine. In Ephesians, the first three chapters deal with doctrine, the last three with duty. Romans 1 to 11 is doctrine, 12 on is duty. That's Paul's standard way of doing it. Well, when you're preaching, you can't wait, if you're preaching through a book like Romans, you can't wait, you know, 3 months before you apply it in chapter 12. What you really have to do in teaching those books is to look at the end of the book and say to yourself, what does Paul make of this? How does he apply this? And then often you will take something here in the end of the book and bring it back earlier in your preaching in the epistle, because you can't treat Ephesians the way the readers read Ephesians.
The
because they could read it at one sitting, but you're expounding it a section at a time. So if I'm expounding this section, I have to make variations in order to apply what Paul is saying immediately to the audience. So you can make logical changes.
So likewise, taking Ephesians for example, if we start at chapter 4 where he talks about the humility, unity aspect of the outworking, you could again dip into the front of the book.
Sure.
With the cause and effect.
Very much so. You take that list in chapter 6 of the armor of God. And you talk about a tough passage to preach. I mean, when you look at the way it is often treated, the preacher will tell you that the armor is like the armor of the Roman soldier. Okay, that's fine. And then we'll learn about the helmet, we'll learn about the breastplate, and all this sort of thing. What often doesn't ever get addressed is, why does Paul associate salvation with a helmet? Why not the shield of salvation? Why does he associate shoes with peace? Feet shod with the preparation of the gospel of peace. I mean, I understand the Roman soldiers, how they dressed, and that's often the way the sermon ends, but the big question is, why a particular piece of armor? Now, we will often do it by saying that the sword of the Spirit is the Word of God. That's the offensive weapon. Okay? But you don't do it with the rest of it. So you have to ask yourself, you know, is Paul just sort of dilly-dallying here? Well, I take it that every bit of this armor that he's referring to, he's referred to in the first chapters of Ephesians. So that, the feet shod with the preparation of gospel peace, he has a whole section that the gospel has broken down the middle wall of partition. And he has declared peace between Jew and Gentile. So it would mean, I think, that wherever you go, wherever you walk, as opposed to the Roman soldier, wherever he went, it was military. It was war. It was authority that frightened people. You go, wherever you go, there is peace. What you're doing is bringing people together. What you're doing is bringing groups that are ordinarily divided in the society together. But it goes back to what he has been doing in the early part of the book. So that if you're going to handle chapter 6, you've got to do it then in the light of the first three chapters or the previous chapters. Okay, that's what we want to achieve. So let me go through the stages. They're in the book, but I'd like to sort of play harmony to that melody, that is, to expand on it a bit more. The question is, you know, this is what I want to achieve. It's a good thing to have it in mind. But how do I do it? Okay. What do I do as I am working my way through this preparation? Well, the first thing you do is to study the text and gather your notes. Kind of thing we were looking at, say, in Matthew 18. What I do as a practical matter is I use a legal-size pad. I find I can get more on a legal-sized pad than I can on a regular sheet of paper. Nothing spiritual or magic about it. I have found, however, much to my interest, that numbers of ministers that I know who prepare, use a large pad. Okay. More important, when I'm going through a passage, I will, if I have, just say, 12 verses, I will number each a page for each verse. Verse 1, verse 2, verse 3, verse 4, verse 12. I will also have a page for possible introductions. Maybe half a page for possible introductions. I will have a page that I usually set aside for trying to state the subject, the complement, all of the things I want to do with the idea. Okay. When I'm working in the passage, and I'm, say, working with a commentary, if I find a comment that applies to verse, I have one other page for the whole passage, but a verse that applies to verse 2, I put that on the second page. Something in verse 8, I put that on my 8th page. So what I do is try to segment my material so that the comments apply to the particular verses. On one page, I will find that some commentaries will give me an insight into the whole passage. And so I have another page, and I just put that down. As I'm working, putting this down, I am always trying to ask the question, what's the subject? What's he talking about? I discovered that many commentators will get... details. They got all the leaves, but you can't find the tree. But when I get a tree, when I see the argument of the passage, then all at once things begin to fit and click. But you don't understand the passage unless you can answer the question, what's the subject? What's the person talking about? And then if I say, oh yeah, this is what he's, you know, then what is the major assertion? What is he talk? What is he saying about that? What one or two things? And I sketch that out. So my, yeah, there is, sometimes I use half a page. You don't have to use a lot of space. But all I'm trying to do is to keep separate different kinds of things I'm doing. Because what will happen is if you just sort of keep writing, things get lost. And I'm just trying to segment out what I'm doing. So the first stage is to study the passage, collect the notes. The second stage, then, is to try to relate the parts to the whole, so I get the subject, and I look for the complement. One thing I have found helpful is to paraphrase the passage, putting in all of the connections, stating all the connections that the biblical writer may only imply. So I will rewrite the passage in my own words. I try not to fall into the trap of saying what the biblical writer is saying, because I don't know what he's talking about. So I have to make a judgment. So I try to paraphrase it. And it's very important, I find, to state the connections. That is, the biblical writer may have just the word "but," but I will tend to say, "We are called." The passage: "We are called to be sons of light." But it is a more difficult thing for us to live this out, because, and then I'll hit the next verse. I mean, what is the connection? What is the logical, psychological connection? The writer usually does it with a word. In fact, sometimes doesn't do it. But I will write that out. I was chatting with some of you the other day, and we were talking about a passage. And I don't know, better not do it, it'll take too much time. But as I was working in a passage in the book of Hebrews, I was trying to paraphrase the passage, and it wouldn't paraphrase. That section in Hebrews where it says the word of God, sharp and powerful, any two-edged sword, dividing to the joint and marrow. And you, if you look at that, you say, what in the world is he talking about the Bible here for? almost all the commentators get off on the Bible. What's he talking about the Bible here? Where it doesn't fit. And I couldn't paraphrase it. It just wouldn't work. I mean, I kept trying to find some connection and it wouldn't work. It occurred to me that he isn't talking about the Bible. In that passage, he's talking about Jesus Christ. In the beginning of Hebrews, God has spoken unto us in these last days by his Son. He tells us immediately following that God sees us, knows us, and then he talks about having a high priest. And suddenly, when I did that, it fit. I mean, that's what the argument is about. Now, paraphrase helps you to do that. It forces you, it just forces you to come to grips with how the passage is put together. So, when I'm through this second stage, I have tried to state the subject and the complement and a rough outline of how the author is developing what he is doing. And I mean rough in the sense that what's the major thing this is the subject, the complement, what are the major things, ways he develops it. It's not anything formal, but I will hope to know the flow of thought. Right? Now the exegetical idea, that's what the biblical writer is talking about to the biblical readers, and the flow of thought. So one question you have when you get this is, will it preach? you could get an idea, but you say to yourself, will it preach? Will it go? I mean, a lot of ideas that you can have, good stuff, but you can't preach on them. They don't do much. So the third thing I do is to take this exegetical idea and submit it to what I call the three functional questions. Okay, now let me stop for a minute and talk about these three functional questions. Whenever you make a statement, there's only one of three things you can do with it. One is, you can explain it. The second thing you can do is to prove it. Third thing you can do with it is apply it. You may say it again, you may restate it, but I mean, the only way I know you can develop it is to either explain it, prove it, or apply it. That's all you can do. That's the way thought works. I mean, any statement, not just any statement. If you say, it's going to be a hot day tomorrow. If that's worth even expanding, if you want to explain it, you'd say, understand it's going to be 30 degrees. If you wanted to prove it, you'd say, it's going to be a hot day tomorrow. I was watching the telly, and that's what the weather person said. What? Yeah. Or you may apply it. It's going to be a hot day tomorrow. I'm going to take the day off, go down to the beach. Wait, just a simple statement like that. If you expand it, all you can do with it is to explain it, prove it, or apply it. There's nothing else you can do. So the three functional questions are merely reflecting that reality. One, the first functional question is, what does that mean? That has to do with explanation. The second functional question is that true? Do I really believe it? It deals with validity. Third functional question is, well, so what? What difference does it make? That's application, consequence. I know sometimes tough to get this through, but you've got to understand that's all you can ever do with a statement. Aside from restating it, saying it again, all you can ever do is to explain it, prove it, or apply it. That's the way thought develops. Then the functional questions, we call them functional questions because you're asking, what is the function of this idea? Simply play off that basic structure of thought. By the way, those three questions are sequential. That is, nobody gives a rip about your proving what you have not explained. That is, if I don't understand you, I really don't understand you, I don't care about your proving, I want to know what you mean. Now, sometimes I can misinterpret you and then want you to prove it. But you don't prove what you don't understand. And you don't apply what you don't believe. If I am not persuaded, if I don't agree that that's true, then you're applying it is a waste of time. Sometimes when people say, look, don't preach at me, what they're really saying is, don't work on the third functional question before you've worked on the first two. I wouldn't put it in quite those words, but what you get in some kind of preaching is a harangue, a long sense of oughts. You ought, you must, you should. Without explaining or demonstrating the validity of what you're talking about, you simply jump to this third question. But if I don't change my perceptions, I'm not going to change my life. So they are sequential in the way people handle them. So the first thing I do is to take this idea of mine that I've worked with out of the text, and I deal with the first functional question. What does this mean? And when I deal with this, I deal with it in two ways. I'm asking, does this concept and its development need explanation? And the first thing I ask is the author of the Bible dealing with the first functional question? That is that what he's doing? In 1 Corinthians chapter 8, as you know, Paul is dealing with the subject of meat offered to idols. It's an enormous question in that church. As I understand the passage, Paul is dealing with the first functional question. He says, now about food sacrificed to idols. We know that we all possess knowledge. Knowledge puffs up, love builds up. Man who thinks he knows something does not yet know as he ought to know, but the man who loves God is known by God. So then, and apply that about eating food sacrificed to idols. We know that an idol is nothing. And doctrinally, an idol is nothing more than a piece of stone set up on a stone slab. It is nothing. And there is no God but one. There are not other gods. The pagans worship other gods, but there are no other gods. You know that theologically. For even if there are so-called gods that the pagans worship, whether in heaven or on earth, as indeed there are many gods and many lords, that's what the pagans call their idols, yet for us there is but one God, the Father, from whom all things come. Okay. As you read that, he is saying there are two ways of approaching this problem of meat offered to idols. One is theologically on the basis of your knowledge. Do it on the basis of theology and your knowledge, you're free to eat. But, he says, in verse 7, not everyone knows this doctrine. Some people are still so accustomed to idols that when they eat such food, they think of it as having been sacrificed to an idol. And since their conscience is weak, it's defiled. But you also know this, food doesn't bring us near to God. We're no worse if we don't eat, no better if we do. Be careful, however, that the exercise of your freedom doesn't become a stumbling block to the weak. If anyone has a weak conscience, sees you with knowledge, eating in an idol's temple, won't he be emboldened to eat what is sacrificed to idols? So this weaker brother, for whom Christ died, is destroyed by your knowledge. And he states the principle in verse 13. Therefore, if what I eat causes my brother to fall into sin, I'll never eat meat again, so that I'll not cause him to fall. What Paul is doing is saying there's two ways of coming to this. He's explaining. One is knowledge, the other is love. And while you ought to operate on the basis of knowledge, theology, doctrine, understanding, love will supersede it. Because you will not do something that will cause somebody else to go back to the old life. And by the way, that is what weakness is here. It isn't that Aunt Millie gets upset. It's that Aunt Millie is endangered of doing the same thing. And if she did it, she'd go back to what her own Aunt Millie's old life was. But what you have is an explanation. Now, in the explanation is obviously application. I mean, once you get the explanation, you know what to do. If, for example, I borrow a car while I'm here, and the tire develops a flat, and I look at the trunk and I can't even find the spare. And the spare is one of those little old donut things. It doesn't look like it fit the wheel. So I call Alan. I say, Alan, got a flat. I'm not sure how to get this thing fixed. And he says, well, you know, the trunk, if you pull up the lid, you'll find there's a tire. And over to the right in the compartment, there are some tools. Now, the tire is only designed to go a couple of hundred miles, but it may be small, but it'll work. Take it out, and then take the nuts off, and you need to be careful because there's a lock on that hub that you've got to open or else you're going to strip them off. So, okay, I get that. So I go out. I say, okay, I can see the stuff. So he said, all right, you got it? You take it out. Take off the hubcap, you pump it up, you take off the hubcap, you know, it gives me the whole thing. He doesn't have to say to me, now, I adjure you, in the name of all that is sacred, fix the tire. Oh, go out and, fix the tire. If my tire is down and he gives me a good explanation about how to get that tire fixed, inherent in the good explanation is the application. I don't have to lay any shoulds and oughts on me. You just have to tell me what the principle is. So, when you say something is an explanation, it doesn't mean it does not have application. A clear explanation can be one of the most forceful ways to get people to change. They know what to do. They know what the principle is. Let's get the principle. If you know you need the principle, then you're home free. These people had evidently written to Paul about this whole question of meat offered to idols. It was their question. Now he's going to answer it for them. And once you get the principle, you know, you act on the basis of knowledge. But if there is a conflict where somebody else will be spiritually hurt, love supersedes it. Okay. That doesn't answer all my questions, but it gives me a principle to operate on. Yes.
Applying it primarily to the purpose of the passage and saying, is this passage primarily a question about explanation? Or do you say, what do I mean by the exegetical idea that I've drawn out? There seems to be a little bit of an overlap.
Okay, what I'm trying to do here is this. I'm trying to put it in it bluntly. I'm trying to find out what we'll preach. I mean, what do I have to say? What am I going to do? So one of the things I have to ask is, are there things in this idea that I've come up with it that I've got to explain? Okay. If the biblical writer is explaining, then that makes it relatively easy for me. Okay. Well, let me work my way through this. Otherwise, and then if it doesn't work, 1 Corinthians 12, verses 1 to 13. There you have Paul telling us, explaining the basis on which the Holy Spirit gives spiritual gifts to the church. And his basic answer is, it's up to him. He doesn't do it on the basis of favorites. He does it, it's up to him. But if you notice in verses 14 to 20, he has an illustration. And he's talking about the human body. A body isn't made up of one part, but of many. He is trying to get across the truth that while there is a oneness of the church, there is diversity of gifts. And diversity does not rule out oneness. So, his illustration is, now the body isn't made up of one part, but of many. If the foot should say, because I'm not a hand, I don't belong to the body, it wouldn't for that reason cease to be part of the body, would it? If the ear should say, because I'm not an eye, I don't belong to the body, it wouldn't for that reason cease to be part of the body. If the whole body were an eye, where would the sense of hearing be? And if the whole body were an ear, where would the sense of smell be? But in fact, and he's going to apply it, God has arranged the parts in the body, every one of them, just as he wanted them to be. If they were all one part, where would the body be? As it is, there are many parts, but one body. That's his principle. What I want you to see here is that Paul is using an illustration, an analogy, to explain. You can use illustrations in every one of the functional questions. Here he is using it to explain. When I pick up an illustration in the scriptures, I've got to ask, what's the apostle doing? What's he explaining? And what functional question is he asking? So if I know that here Paul is explaining a truth, I have to, in my introduction, raise a need for that explanation. I know that's going to come, but here I'm just simply saying, all right, in this explanation, what do I have to explain? What do I have to put down? Well, if I were going through 1 Corinthians 8, one of the things I'd have to do, I know I've got to explain meat offered to idols. What in the world is the problem those people are facing? What's meat offered to idols? So I know that even though Paul assumes it, he knows what that is, they know what it is. My people may not. They may not understand that when the offering of the meat was brought to the altar, a small part, sometimes no more than the hair of the chin of the animal, small part was actually offered on the altar. Large hunk was given to the priest as his honorarium, another hunk was given to the worshiper. The priest, at the end of the day, when there's no refrigeration, had all of this meat, the offering. What he had to do was to sell it. So at the temple, there was a meat market where people came and bought their meat. And if you've got a large hunk of meat as a result of being to the temple, you had to do something with it. No refrigeration, so there were places at the temple, near the temple, or in your home where you'd have a feast, okay? The question was, if all the meat in Corinth, or virtually all of it, had been offered to an idol in the morning, to Epaphrodite, the goddess of sexual love, with all kinds of unspeakable degenerate things going on, could you eat that? A few years ago, Bonnie and I were over in Japan, and we went up to visit the Shinto temple up on top of a high hill, and it was one of their days. They were having a big time, incense and beating the gongs, and you know kind of scary stuff, like a Baptist in a Methodist church, and I didn't. But we came down off of that thing, and down at the bottom, there were some Japanese ladies selling ice cream. And so I said to Bonnie, look, let me buy you ice cream. She said, I wouldn't eat anything within 5 miles of this place. She was feeling what those Corinthians felt. could you eat meat that had been offered to idols? Now, I would have to spend some time explaining that to people. Otherwise, what Paul is saying makes no sense. So, I've got to have a section of my message to explain what Paul is taking for granted. So, that the second question, the first is, what is the biblical writer doing? The second question, is this what my audience needs? Are there elements in this passage that the biblical writer takes for granted that my audience needs to know? And I find it's very, very helpful to jot that down, and I know I've got to explain it. If in 1 Corinthians 12:13 you read the phrase, by one Spirit are we all baptized into one body and all made to drink of one Spirit. Paul refers to the baptism of the Spirit almost as a throwaway line. But I'm talking to people today. They have all kinds of stuff in their head. Rushing mighty wind, speaking in strange languages, all kinds of experiences. I know I'm going to have to spend some time talking about what the Bible means by the baptism of the Spirit. As I come to it, it may just be a throwaway line for Paul, but it's not a throwaway line in our culture. Okay? And so I know that that's something that has to be explained. So the first thing I am asking is, what is the first functional question? Is that what the biblical writer is doing? Are there things I have to explain that Paul didn't explain? Second functional question. Is that really true? Do I believe it? Yes.
Explanation.
Yeah, there would be some times in which, if I were preaching regularly, I would feel that I might have to stop in a series and do an entire message on a key concept. Especially, take something like the baptism of the Holy Spirit. I mean, as you well know, all kinds of churches have all kinds of views of it. If I were going through the Corinthian letter as a pastor, I would take a sermon to talk about what it is, what it isn't, so forth. Simply because I know Paul assumes it. Now, it wouldn't have to do that. I could simply say that what Paul is saying is that by the baptism of the Holy Spirit, all of us are placed into the body of Christ. And I would spend maybe a paragraph doing that. But I would also know if there are people who would be troubled by that or wouldn't accept that that paragraph isn't going to win, because I'm merely giving an explanation without really showing them the biblical support for it. So it would depend on my audience.
Topical, or would it be expositional on the basis of some other passage?
Yeah, it would be expositional on the basis of what I could keep that. I could keep that doctrine within 1 Corinthians chapter 12, but I would also want to show what it is, say, in the book of Acts. You follow me? That is, it would be expositional in that I would look at the three different places in Acts, baptism of the Spirit. Is at least the speaking of tongues is dealt with, and then I would also stay within the 1 Corinthians 12. Yes, right. And the thing that makes it exposition is that what I would be doing would be drawn from those passages. I would be imposing an order on those because I take it from here and here and here. Whereas often, as I'm doing exposition, the passage gives me the order.
Because I've done that, and then I wondered whether in the course of this, whether that really is what we're talking about.
Oh, no. You can have a paragraph exposition, but no, there is a doctrinal exposition. It's tougher to do because I've got to go to each passage and treat it honestly in its context to say that's what it's saying. Yes.
It appears to me this speaks loads to us in our planning For if 1 week I'm going to preach from the first chapter of Jeremiah about some particular matter, it's going to take loads of explanation. The next week I'm going to say Romans 1:18. Here I'm in a different world, different context, and loads of explanation. So it appears to me it speaks a lot to us in a planning and saving time rather than chopping here and chopping there.
If you jump all over the Bible, I mean, one Sunday you're here, one Sunday you're there, that's an enormous, if you're going to be faithful to the text, that's an enormous load. On the other hand, if you speak for America, you don't dare assume on a given Sunday that all the people were there for all your previous sermons. You can say, you know, in some form, we have looked at what this is, and this is, you know, what it's about. Planning is, I don't know how you operate without planning. I can't imagine the sheer terror of coming to Monday after Sunday and wondering, what am I going to do next week? That is the one advantage of exposition, is at least you've solved an enormous problem. What am I going to preach on next Sunday? And I find that, you know, I do a radio program, and it's every day. It's a international program, I guess. And I prepare them, you know. When I get back to the States, I will be doing, I put together 20 of them, and I have to go do those. I mean, that preparation seems to me, even though it's a month's worth, it comes every 2 weeks. And when I was preaching regularly, I found Sunday came every 3 days. I mean, it just seemed to me I got out of one Sunday, I was into the next one. And in the economy of time, you do have to plan. The second functional question, is that really true? Do I or my hearers believe it? This is validity. If I state it and I know they won't believe it, or I suspect they won't, the question then is, why not? What stands in their way? Now, when I talk about validity here, I am... talking about psychological validity. And I mean by that, good Christians say they believe a lot of things. But down deep inside, they don't. You hear people say, you know, God always answers prayer. Sometimes he says yes, sometimes he says no, sometimes he says, wait a while. And you know as well as I that's a cop-out. I mean, on that basis, idols always answer prayer. Sometimes they say yes, sometimes they know. Wait a while. I mean, if I talk about answered prayer, I mean answered in terms of the asking. My son, when he was small, came to me and said, Dad, you know, can I have 75 cents for an ice cream cone? And I said, no. He'd go out and say, that's my dad. Always answers my request. Most of the time he says no. I mean, you know and I do, there's all kinds of games we play. But the person in the pew may not be sophisticated enough to take you on, but she knows that you're playing games. Down deep inside, there are things they should believe, but they can't believe. They don't believe. And I have to wrestle with that. I think in Spurgeon's day, in the 1800s, what he had, at least on the fringe of where people were, was a sense of guilt. He could deal with that sense that people had that they had failed morally, because the Judeo-Christian ethic dominated. The people weren't, I mean, they weren't going to church a lot, but it was there. And you can tell it as you read the sermons of that time. You can't count it out in Australia and America today. The one thing you can count on is a sense of doubt. And that's come because of our educational system. You go through a system that constantly says you got to ask questions. If you expect them to shut off their brains when they walk through the door of the church, they won't do it. So validity is one of the strong questions that we have to work with. So my question is, I look at this, is this what the writer of the scriptures is doing? Is he working with validity? And you can see, you know, Paul does this. Look at 1 Corinthians 15. He's talking about the resurrection from the dead. He's talking about the resurrection of the of our bodies from the dead. He's not talking about the resurrection of Jesus. That's what he uses to prove. By the way, I think it's one of the strongest passages in the Bible dealing with the resurrection of Christ. Strong because Paul here isn't trying to prove the resurrection of Jesus. What he says to the Corinthians is, you met all the witnesses. That you believe. It's just, you know, you don't have to believe the inspiration of 1 Corinthians. Look at how Paul proves this. He says, you know that. Now, on the basis of that, I want to talk about your resurrection. Because the Greeks believed in immortality. They didn't believe in the resurrection of the body. But when you come to verse 35, somebody asks a question. Somebody asks, all right, Paul, how are the dead raised? With what kind of body will they come? And Paul said, that's a stupid question. How foolish. You can hear the question. Paul, here's a sailor. He's out in the Mediterranean Sea. Well, he's out there fishing. He has a heart attack. He dies. So they throw him overboard. And the fish come and they eat him. And then a fisherman, shores of the Mediterranean, catches the fish, cooks it for supper, and eats it, and it becomes this bowel movement on the sand. And now you're going to tell me, how are the dead raised? You know, Paul said, that's a dumb question. I think it's a pretty good question, but he said it was dumb. And look at how he answers it. What you sow doesn't come to life unless it dies. And when you sow, you don't plant a body that will be, but just a seed. Perhaps of wheat or something else. But God gives it a body as he has determined, and to each kind of seed he gives his own body. All flesh isn't the same. Men have one kind of flesh, animals another, birds another, fish another. There are heavenly bodies and there are earthly bodies. I read that and I think of growing up in New York City in the midst of a concrete jungle. Well, they wanted to show us how things grew. We thought milk came in bottles, and we discovered it came in cows, and they wanted us to know that, you know, plants grew. So I remember planting some lima beans in a little box windowsill. Put it in, and nothing happened. It went for a couple of days, nothing happened. And so I dug it up, and the beans had become squish. So I covered it up, figuring I blew the assignment. And a few days later, they began to sprout. What came out of the ground was different than what was put in the ground, but it was connected to what was in the ground. So Paul says, if you understand DNA molecules, whatever is put into the earth, it's like a seed. But what comes out is connected to it, but it's different from it. That's an analogy. It's not an explanation of how the dead are raised. It's an analogy that says, if this happens over when you're planting your grain, you can see an analogy with what God does. Here is an illustration used to give validity, to win belief. It doesn't prove it, but psychologically. Oh, yeah. I always wondered about that lima bean, how it worked. His point is that it's connected. Or look at 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 7 to 12. Here he's arguing that he had a right to be paid as an apostle. That was his right. And so he's going to prove it. Verse 7, he says, who serves as a soldier at his own expense? Soldiers go to war, they don't have to go raise their own support. Government will try to scrape it up for them. Who plants a vineyard, doesn't eat of the grapes? got a vineyard, you may not have much more to eat, but you've got a lot of grapes to eat. Who tends a flock and doesn't drink of the milk? People have dairy herds, they have a lot of milk and cheese. Do I say this merely from a human point of view? That is the three illustrations he gave, or human illustrations out of human life. By the way, I think the question was asked yesterday about Erwin Lutz's sermon. It's perfectly proper in a sermon to give illustrations out of human life, and here is proof out of human life. But, he says, I don't leave it there. Doesn't the law say the same thing? It's written in the law of Moses, don't muzzle the ox while it treads out the grain. You know, you've got an ox. The Old Testament says he's he's out there going around and around. Take that muzzle off. You ought to have a right to eat. Is it about oxen that God's concerned? I thought it would have been. Read the law. It seemed like he's concerned about oxen. Well, yeah, the principle is if it applies to an oxen, it certainly applies to a human being. So the law says the same thing. Surely he says this for us, doesn't he? Yes. This was written for us, because when the plowman plows and the thresher threshes, they ought to do so in the hope of sharing in the harvest. If we've sown spiritual seed among you, is it too much that we reap a material harvest from you? If others have this right of support from you, shouldn't we have it? But Paul says we didn't use the right. But then he gives it one more shot in verse 13. Don't you know that those who work in the temple get their food from the temple, and those who serve at the altar share what is offered in the altar? That is, ordinary life shows that to you. The law says that. If you watch the way people operate in the temple, he lives off the offering. And then finally, his trump card, verse 14, the same way the Lord has commanded, those who preach the gospel should receive their living from the gospel, that the workman is worthy of his hire. And it didn't come from the labor unions in Australia. It came from Jesus Christ. Now, what I want you to see here is Paul is piling illustration upon illustration, answering the question of validity. He is proving that as an apostle, he had a right to be paid. He's going to argue later on he didn't take the right, but that's what he's proving, and he's using illustrations to do it. So you have to ask, what's the biblical writer doing? But he's not explaining; he's proving, and he's going for validity. So I have to ask the same question of my audience. I suppose I laid this out for them. Would they accept this concept as valid? And if so, why not? If so, why? If not, why not? One of the great benefits of reading C.S. Lewis is that he constantly works with the second functional question. He raises a question and you think, good night, yeah, what do you do with that? Turn the page. And he deals with validity. And the reason I think that Lewis has, even though he died in 1963, the reason he has a larger readership today than when he died is because he's speaking to the question of validity in the 20th century. So, Mike, what I have to ask, what kind of evidence or argument would it take to get my audience to accept this? Often, this demands an illustration by analogy. Some analogy to win belief. Sometimes it may be other kind of proof. Sometimes it needs a good explanation. Let me show you what I mean. Suppose you were to preach Romans 8:28. Take it at its face value. God works all things together for good to them who love God, to them who are the called according to his purpose. You quote that verse. This is the idea of your sermon. God works everything for good to those who love him, to those who are called according to his purpose. How does your audience respond to that? You're sitting there, you got this. How do you think the audience responds? Right. And they immediately think of the things that are not good. Be even more specific, Margaret. Like what? Give me something that... Okay, my child was run over and badly hurt and so forth. People not only respond to that abstractly, they respond to it personally. What about the widow down the road who is a Christian, and her husband was a devout Christian, and he just died of cancer after a very painful 4 months of illness, and she's left with two small children? How's that good? That is, if people don't respond with the abstract problem of evil and pain in the universe. They start with people. I know if I don't deal with that, you just have a gut feeling. I don't deal with that sense of validity. I can shout this verse, I can yell it, I can put it up on posters, and they sit there and say, yeah, but what about Aunt Louise, who served Jesus Christ all her life and just broke her hip and she can't get into a nursing home? Okay, you know. So I may have to, at that point, say, in order to understand what Paul is saying, in order to establish validity, you've got to understand what he means when he says all things work together for good. It's easy to think he is saying all things will be pleasant for. You've got to understand what he means when he says to those who love God and are called according to his purpose. What are the purposes of God in this chapter? There are things I must explain about this before you can decide that Christians get a free pass. They don't have to suffer what other people suffer. Okay. Now, you see, there's a case in which when I know I'm going to approach this at the level of validity. I've got to face these questions immediately. But they don't need an analogy. They need an explanation of this text, because the reason they've gotten to the point they've gotten in their response is that they don't understand what Paul is saying. So as I'm working with this, I mean, I'd immediately say, this would pop into people's minds. And that, I'll jot that down over in my page for introductions. I know that that's a need. I can work with that. Because that's how people will respond.